Hello and welcome to Ed Talks, the podcast from King Edward's School Birmingham and King Edward's High School for Girls, where I talk to old Edwardians who've gone on to have wonderful and varied careers. This podcast is listened to by old Edwardians from both the boys and girls school, but also current students as a way of hopefully showing you the many number of different careers that you could go into after leaving school. Today, I am joined by historical novelist Lindsay Davis. Lindsay, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you very much, Ben, for inviting me.
How are you? You've had a busy week.
I'm good, yeah. Well, I'm writing at the moment, so in theory it's busy.
Well, in terms of your writing, you've been writing for over 30 years, producing a book a year, which is phenomenal. Although last year it was two books. Am I right in thinking that's the case?
I occasionally do extras. Yeah. I do novellas Wonderful. From time to time, which is quite hard work, in fact. But two whole books would be a bit beyond me.
Before we talk about your writing, I'd love to talk about school and also Birmingham as a city. You left school in 1967, is that right?
Yes, I think it is. It's so long ago, I can hardly remember. I'm very proud of being a Brummie. I always was very conscious of that.
And what was Birmingham like in the 60s as a teenager?
Somewhat austere. We didn't do things that nowadays people do. We never went out, of course, in those days.
We never go out these days, Lindsay.
Well, no, that's true. I found lockdown quite normal, really. It seemed like what I was used to for much of my early life, which is the part that affects you most, I think. It was well behaved. We didn't drink. We certainly barely looked out of the window at the boys' school from KEHS. We weren't supposed to look out of the window at the boys, though I believe there were some raw girls who did.
And what was your experience like at school? Did you enjoy it?
I did, and I think it was very, very good for me. Some of it was very strange because I came from predominantly a working class background. I was only the second person in my quite large family who went to university, although my father taught in a polytechnic. So there were subjects that were terrifying. Things like hockey and algebra had never crossed the paths of any of my family before. Latin, dare I mention Latin. It was strange in some ways, and I was a timid child, so that was scary. But at the same time, I had felt at home since I first went into the hall when we came for the entrance examination. And I think the discipline of it was very good for me.
What part of Birmingham did you grow up in, Lindsay?
I grew up in a mixture of Ward End when I was at primary school and then Hall Green. And, of course, Edgbaston, where I now live again. There's this terrible draw to people who went to KE that you come crawling back to near where you were taught things and lurk there as though it's some sort of warm cocoon.
And what did your parents do for a living? Because historical novelist, I imagine, wasn't necessarily top of the list.
No, nobody wrote in my family. My grandparents' generation on both sides had been very working class. So in two generations before me, we had toolmakers and butchers and a lamplighter in Victorian times.
Did you always want to write then? Were you writing from a young age?
Yes. In fact, I can remember when I was five at primary school, coming home when we were only learning the alphabet, so before I could even properly write, and saying to my mum that instead of having to copy things out of the book, we could make up our own stories. And I thought that was the most magical thing in the world. And so from very early on, I could write stories. And I think nobody was surprised when I finally became a writer. But my parents, my mum was trained as a bookkeeper. So from time to time, she did jobs like that. Once in the fish market, which was good because she would bring home spare fish every night. My dad was a lecturer. He taught various courses to do with politics and public administration. And I think that probably comes through in my writing because I am interested in how the world is run and politics.
And were they interested in you getting a good education? Or was that something?
Absolutely. Going right back to my working class grandparents, we were the kind of left-wing people people who believed that self-education was the thing, or formal education if you could get it. There had been problems for the previous generation in that they couldn't afford to send their children to grammar school and university. People had to get jobs as soon as they were able to. But with the free education that we had, those of us who were born after the war, as far as we could go, the better we would be supported, even girls, because I did grow up in the era when people would say, oh, are you going to send her to university because she's a girl? You were expected to have a family and not need to be educated.
And did you feel that way?
No. And I think that was part of King Edward's, that they expected us to do the very best we could to educate ourselves as best we could and to use our talents as best we could.
You said you didn't look out the window much at the boys' school.
Nah.
But did you manage to spend much time in Birmingham, in the city centre? What was Birmingham like in the 60s?
Well, it was just shops, really. I used to, every now and then, I would go with my best friend who lived at the end of the road. We'd suddenly decide on a Saturday to go up to town and we'd walk around the shops, but we didn't have very much money to buy things. It wasn't the sort of commercial life for people in families that we have now. We'd grown up with very little and we expected to have very little, but we looked a lot. We got very interested in fashion, but had to make our own.
One of the things that the author Lee Child talked to me about was the notion that he felt almost that going to King Edward's was not necessarily just for him. It was almost a kind of societal, a marker for his parents to say, I have got a child at King Edward's. Did you feel that same thing?
I think so, and especially with a father who was in the world of education. They did debate, I think, whether to send me. And I do suspect, this is a very hard thing to say, but I suspect if it had been a fee-paying school instead of a direct grant school in those days, I might not have gone. And then my whole life would have been different. Once you went, with the council fortunately paying my fees for me, there was a sort of sense that you'd been given a privilege. And I felt this at university afterwards as well. And that therefore you had to do well. It was your duty to do well. A kind of Protestant ethic came into it, obviously. But also the sense of responsibility that you shouldn't waste this wonderful opportunity that had been given to you. And it was a wonderful opportunity. And I tried not to waste it. And I think still today as a writer, I have that sense of I've got this ability to write and please people, and it's my duty to do it.
In what ways do you think your life would have been different? What opportunities did King Edward's give you that you don't think you may have had in another place?
I think I would always have been a very determined, forthright sort of a woman, because that was the kind of family I came from. So in some ways, I would have made my own way. It gave me the academic world. That was the main thing. And I have used that. I've used the, not so much the subject I studied at university, which was English, though obviously I do know how to read a text and edit a text because I'd done that. But it gave me the feeling that I could do whatever I wanted to do. I could find out whatever I wanted to find out through research. And then I had the tools to judge things and to use whatever I found out. And that is very much what King Edward's gave me in the first place, and later on university as well. But I went to university equipped already by K.
Would you say that you were, in terms of subjects, an all-rounder? Or was it very much kind of English history, those subjects that...
Very much English and history, yes. I didn't even take my science O-level because I found it so hard to... I could understand it, but I couldn't be bothered to learn it. I just wasn't interested. And it's clear to this day that I'm a words person, not a numbers person. I can very easily write a date wrong. Although my brain understands maths, I'm not fluent in the same way that I'm effortlessly fluent with words, which I've just bungled one off. But and I wasn't a very good linguist either. I think I have a very good ear for things, but the solid slog of learning grammar did not appeal.
So school was a happy time for you. When you went to university, did you know, you said you were equipped by King Edwards. Were you ready for university?
I was, but that was partly due to the fact that I stayed on in the legendary third year sixth to do Oxbridge entrance. Before that, I had been very, very shy, probably immature, but I had the extra year when, first of all, we did the term before we took the exams, and that was much freer. So that benefited me academically. And then we had 6 months to do what we wanted to do. And I did voluntary social work, which by its very nature meant I had to talk to people, which I was not good at normally until then. So I got used to dealing with old people and young people, male people and female people, and was therefore in a much stronger position when I finally went, as I did, to Oxford.
I apologise, you introduced it as the legendary third year sixth. I've not heard of that before. So that was another year after your A-levels.
Yeah, if you wanted to apply to Oxford or Cambridge, you didn't have to do this, but KE gave us the facility that we could stay on for a term, and we took the exams at the end of that term, just before Christmas. And we had special training, a very small group of us, really. So it was good in that it was a very small group, because that prepared you for a tutorial system where you would have to speak and you couldn't hide and pretend you'd done your homework when you hadn't. And they tailored it to the strengths that we had. We wrote essays that we wouldn't have normally written for GCSE, as it's now called, or O-levels and A-levels, as we called it. And it was much, much better as a way to develop you. And it meant you were a year more mature when you went to university as well.
So you graduated from Oxford University. What did you do next?
Well, you had to get a job, didn't you? And I was so casual and laid back, I hadn't applied for any jobs. So I came home until my mother, a good woman in many ways, gently said that if I was going to live at home, she would like some contributions to the housekeeping, which basically meant I had to get a job. And I still was very laid back and useless, frankly. So the first thing that I did was apply to the civil service to be a filing clerk, a temporary filing clerk. And then I just stayed in the civil service. I did apply formally and went to London to get away from home, really, because I thought the streets were paved with gold, as you innocent little Brummies always think that. 40 years later, I noticed they weren't and came back home.
So when did you start writing? Was it, because obviously a creative career is very difficult to start in.
Yes.
It's very difficult to maintain.
And although we are perhaps talking to current students, one of the things I have to say is that if you want to be a novelist, obviously I could write beautifully, string sentences together. But if you want to be a novelist, you actually have to know about life. And so when you finish university at 22 or whatever it is, you're not ready. You really have got to go out like Flora Post in Cold Comfort Farm and gather materials for a novel for a long time. I started actually to write when I left the civil service in disgust when I was 35. And I always say that's the age when you should begin, because you know enough about the misery and the joy that your characters are going to have to go through.
Why did you leave the civil service? Or would you rather not go into that?
No, I'll go into it because it's part of me having been educated at King Edward's Girls' School to believe that talent will out and that it didn't matter that I was a girl. Whereas I found in the department I was in that it did matter and that it was much easier for men to get promoted than women. I had friends who were just a little bit ahead of me, so I observed it in them. It wasn't just what I felt. I knew that really good women were not being valued and given their rewards. And eventually it got too much for me and I resigned in a curious way. I wrote them a note, which I kept for a fortnight in my desk so that they couldn't say, you need to think about this. I could say I had thought about it. And I said I would resign in 6 months' time on the anniversary of the day that I joined, because I like things to be neat. And then when it came to the 6 months, they hadn't thought I meant it. So they suddenly had to ask me to stay another fortnight while they found somebody to replace me in the job I was doing. And I thought you had to have a real job. But at the same time, I thought, I am 35, and if I'm ever going to try and be a writer, now might be the time to start. So I didn't leave to be a writer. I didn't think it was allowed. It sounded like too much fun. And it is.
Why do you think in that age men were afforded more possibilities than women?
Well, when I first started, somebody actually said to me, if on a promotion board they have to choose between a man with a family and you, a single girl, obviously he will get the job or the promotion. There was a different way of looking at things. What your contribution was mattered less than other sorts of rules. I actually once went for an interview when I was still at university. I went for an interview for hospital administration, and they actually said, we don't want to take you because you'll get married and you'll leave when we've trained you expensively. Their policy, their actual policy, which at the time was still legal, was to take men if they could get men, not women. So when I started looking for work, there were many alleys that were just blocked off.
In terms of then gender inequality, obviously we talked about in the workplace, did you also experience that wider in society?
Yes, certainly. There were things women couldn't do. There was great prejudice against women wearing trousers, which you think of as a Victorian thing. But at work, there would be debates as to whether a smart trouser suit was allowed, or whether if you were a girl, you had to wear a skirt. And then in your social life, of course, there were different expectations. I used to fight when I had a boyfriend for the right to every other time pay the bill if we went out to eat, because I thought that was a proper thing to do, especially after I had a job, obviously. We had battles that don't exist any longer, and I'm very glad that they don't exist.
It's mad to think this is 50 years ago. That doesn't sound like a long period of time.
In my lifetime, as it were, yes.
Hi, I'm Salma.
And I'm Shweb.
We're student fundraisers talking to you about the Assisted Places Fund.
So, I suppose you're wondering, why should you donate to the Assisted Places Fund?
Essentially, we want to help give others the opportunities we were both fortunate enough to have and give them access to our wide-ranging curriculum and ambitious co-curricular programme.
Thank you for listening. And to give, visit the Old Edwardian website.
So, you left the civil service at the age of 35. What did you do next?
I applied for a couple of jobs, but when I did actually start to get interviews offered to me, I realised I didn't want to go. In my last year in the civil service, to cheer myself up, I had written a romantic novel, which I submitted because I saw an advert in The Guardian to a historical novel prize. And I didn't win, but I was a runner-up, which immediately made me think, if my very first attempt, I can be a runner-up. Maybe there's something here. And so I settled down. I'd left the civil service with only £2,000 in a building society. And on that foolish premise, I decided I would try to be a writer. It took me 5 years. So I was living on my £2,000, supplemented eventually by part-time work, because I had to, for 5 years. But once I'd started, I knew that was what I really wanted to take as far as I possibly could.
And where did you start then, in terms of making it a professional career?
I wrote novels set in the period that I thought I wanted to write about, which it will amaze you to know is the English Civil War, somewhat different from the Romans. And then when they were published as magazine serials, which helped me, of course, to survive. In fact, I was paid for my first serial more than I was eventually paid for my first properly published novel. Wasn't working to get a full publisher. And so because I'm a Brummie, I see myself as a manufacturer, and if my product wasn't wanted by the world at large, I had to change my product. So I looked for something that nobody else was doing. This was a terrible mistake, in fact, because you're supposed to copy somebody who's famous and successful. Publishers don't like original work, although they will tell you they do. But I decided I would write popular fiction about the Romans. And first I wrote a straight love story. I won't say it's a romantic novel about the Emperor Vespasian. And then when nobody would publish that, I used the material because I am a person who believes in recycling, and wrote my first Falco novel. And at that point, the very last month before I wouldn't have been able to pay my mortgage, I obtained a publisher and he took two. So it was a series from day one.
I'd love to talk about Falco, because the first novel was released in 1989.
God, yes. Right? It's, there are people reading them who weren't born when they were published. It's terrifying.
In terms of then the Falco series, what was it that drew you to the Romans?
At school, so we're going back to King Edward's, we had a young Latin teacher. She, all teachers seemed to be quite old, but in fact, I now realise she was only a couple of years older than us, and she was in her first job, and she'd come, offered this wonderful job at King Edward. She'd come from a dig in Greece, because that was her main interest, was Greek rather than Roman. So she was interested in something called archaeology, of which most Brummies, including my family, who were a bit disparaging, had never heard. If I can sum it up, in those days, they had an archaeologist on telly in something called Animal, Vegetable and Mineral, which I never saw because my family didn't have a telly at that time. But they hadn't had the Time Team and Gladiator. To sum it up, absolutely, it was the degree that Prince Charles took. So it was seen as wearing sandals and talking to trees. But our teacher, Elise, decided she would start an archaeological society after hours, obviously. And nobody joined it because of this image of it being something for weird people. So to get more people, she made it joint with the boys' school, which most societies were not. So we joined.
But purely for the archaeological finds, not for any flirting.
To sit in the dark with boys watching slides of post holes, but to be with boys. It was our only opportunity, really. And the boys weren't that interesting, I'm sorry. But the archaeology somehow had stuck with me. And what was being dug up in those days was mostly Roman Britain. So most of the young archaeologists who got to be our speakers were talking about things in Britain, which meant we could go and see them on coach tours with cheese and pickle sandwiches. And that started my love of travel, I suppose. We had, for example, she got us a man called Barry Cunliffe, who was digging something on the south coast that he didn't want to say what it was. It was so early in the dig that he didn't want to say, but it turned out to be Fishbourne Roman Palace, one of the best British archaeological sites. And we heard him talking about that while he was first digging it. So we were very fortunate in what Elise provided for us. I still know her. I still see her sometimes. She lives in Lincoln. And if I'm doing a talk in a Lincoln bookshop, I will always have dinner with Elise and thank her for my career.
I'd love you to talk to you about the kind of life of a writer in a minute. But before we do, can you tell us about the Falco series? So who is Falco? And there are 20 novels now, is that right?
There are 20 Falco novels, and now there are almost 10 of his daughter, Flavia Albia, because I needed a change, really. He comes from the radio, although he is also grounded in 1940s detection stories, gumshoe stories, and also stories of upright policemen solving things. And he fitted into that world, it seemed to me, because of the research I'd done into the world of Vespasian. I thought that Rome, the biggest city in the world, was a good match for somewhere like Los Angeles and Philip Marlowe. and that I could write that sort of wisecracking, struggling against the world investigator set in ancient Rome. A mad idea, though many other people are now doing it. I wish they gave me part of their royalties when they do.
What's it like being a writer? Because in terms of the lifestyle, in my head, it feels like quite a solitary profession.
It is, and that actually suits me. I can be social, but I am perfectly happy being on my own. It's also, let's be frank, it's like being a student for the rest of your life. You don't have to get up in the morning if you don't want to. You don't have to write your essay if you don't feel quite alert enough to do it. The only thing is, because I went to King Edward's, I am scared of being told off if I don't hand in my homework. So they give me a deadline. They've learned to work with me. They give me a deadline, and it's the 30th of June. And at midnight on the 30th of June every year for the past 30 years, I have either posted or emailed my homework, which doesn't need much doing to it because I am a King Edward's girl. It's well thought out and nicely typed and full of ideas. There's a whole lot of other stuff which has been, because I write historical novels about Italy, I've had a lot of travel. I've enjoyed that. And I do enjoy meeting my readers. So I've enjoyed the marketing side when you have to go to bookshops and festivals or now go on Zoom and meet your readers. I like that. But what I really like is sitting down and thinking, oh, I can write a story. It's just the same as when I was five and I came scampering home to Mum. Oh, this is so exciting. And it is still exciting.
In terms of travel, you were away from Birmingham for how long then?
Oh, I lived in London for longer than I've lived here. It was over 40 years.
And what brought you back to Edgbaston?
My partner had died and I wanted to downsize because I had the most terrible bad back and I lived in a house with a lot of stairs. So I decided it was time for a move. And looking at houses, I'd always sworn I would never come back to Birmingham. I don't know why, but I had. And one came up that had what I needed, including the room that you can see, because we are on video on Zoom, that's big enough to have my library and to be a place where I work that isn't the rest of the house, because I think that's very important to keep the two things separate.
As we've all found out.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Not many houses have such a wonderful room where you can actually have your office and be separate doing your work.
It must be a really interesting experience growing up somewhere, going away for so long, and then coming back again. What are the differences that you can see in the city?
Well, obviously what they've done to the centre is different. They didn't have the ring road that we now have. So when I came back, the first thing I realised was that I'd got to get the car with the sat-nav because I couldn't find my way around. But on the other hand, I felt immediately at home. There's a friendliness in Birmingham, which I had missed for those 40 years. I used to say the difference is that if you stand at a bus stop in London and turn around and say, how long have you been waiting for then? They'll think you're mad. In Brom, you'll be best friends within 2 minutes because they expect somebody to talk to them. I love the way that on buses, bus conductors would say, all right, Bab. Even to me at 71, this still strikes me as absolutely wonderful. And then I got a bigger cultural life. You would think in London I would have had it all available, but it was too far away from home, really, and too awkward. Whereas now I go to concerts a lot and the theatre a lot when I can. Of course, not for the past year, but I'm starting to finally book them up again. And that has been a joy as well.
You mentioned that the perception that the streets were lined with gold in London when you were younger as a Brummie. If there's someone listening to this now who wants to get to the top of their game, they want to be the best that they can possibly be in their chosen career, do they need to go to London?
I don't think they need to, but it is unfortunately still the centre of the world. And if if you can, I would say go, because it's much easier to leave than to find the resources to go and stay there. It's easier when you're young. I found as I got older that it was a harder city, mainly because of the lack of friendliness. It's worth experiencing it so that you know what it's like, and then you'll be so glad when you come home.
I get the feeling that you're a very proud Brummie. Has that always been part of your identity, even while you've been living?
Yes. Imagine going to a very posh college in Oxford, Lady Margaret Hall, no less, and being a Brummie, a fighting Brummie. That was good.
And did it define you in any way?
It made me much more practical, because we're a manufacturing city. So I went to Oxford, the only girl I knew who could change a plug on a piece of electrical equipment, and given a hammer by my Uncle Wally of Thor Hammer, the Thor Light Lady's Hammer. So I was also the only person who owned anything to put up pictures. It made me a more rounded person, I would say, though whether the posh young ladies I was among would feel the same, I don't know.
Lindsay, I'd like to finally ask you about, I ask this to everybody, not a qualification or a job role, but what characteristic would you say has served you best since you crossed Edgbaston Park Road for the last time?
Thoroughness. Making sure you know exactly what's what about anything. And particularly, of course, in my work as a writer, that's helped me a lot. I'm famous for my accuracy, though I make mistakes, but I'm famous for trying to be accurate.
If you were leaving school this year rather than in 1967, when you think about how society has changed, how gender roles have changed, do you think your life would have been very different if you'd been born 50 years later?
I don't know that we can ever know. The one thing I would like to say to people who are at that stage is your life isn't set the day you leave. The one brilliant thing about King Edward's was that it fitted me to do whatever I wanted. I was always going to be a writer, but I could have been a landscape designer, or I think now I could have been a snooker referee if they'd told me it was a job. You can do whatever you want, because if you haven't already been taught how to do it, you can go and find out for yourself, and you can have the confidence to attack it. And in that sense, there is no difference between me 50 years ago and the young girls who are coming out of school now, or the young boys, indeed, because the world is open to you.
Lindsay, thank you ever so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you, Ben. It's been a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you for listening to Ed Talks. I hope that you've enjoyed today's conversation. If you have, it would be great if you could subscribe to this podcast on whatever app you're listening on, so you can keep up to date with future episodes. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, then we'd really appreciate it if you could leave your feedback in the review section. If you're listening on a platform where you can't leave your comments, then please do email me with your feedback. My email address is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. If you would like to feature on this podcast as a guest, then please email Adelaide Bailey at the Development Office. Her email address is aab@kes.beham.sch.uk. That's aab@kes.beham.sch.uk. She's also the person to email with any news that you think should be featuring in Old Ed's publications, either in print or online. Finally, if you think a podcast would enhance the communications of your business, organisation or charity, then I'd love to talk to you about producing it. My email address again is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. Thank you again for listening, and I hope you'll join me again.